You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
On September 24th last year, a total of 70 FBI agents in the United States raided homes in the cities of Minneapolis, Chicago, and Grand Rapids. They seized documents, computers, cell phones, passports, even family photos and children's art, and subpoenas were issued to 14 people to appear before a grand jury. And this month, still more subpoenas were served, one of them to journalist and Palestine Solidarity activist Maureen Murphy. And Maureen joins me on the phone from Chicago. Good morning, Maureen, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Thank you, Mordecai.
What can you tell us about all the other people who have been served subpoenas?
Well, in December, the U.S. government expanded its fishing expedition into the anti-war and international solidarity movements even further when it subpoenaed or declared its intent to subpoena 9 Palestine Solidarity and Palestinian American community activists here in Chicago. And so most of us were visited by the FBI and have been summoned to appear before a federal grand jury in Chicago on January 25th.
The FBI search warrants and the subpoenas indicate that they are looking for evidence of, quote, material support of terrorism, end of quote. What does material support of terrorism mean?
Well, now it can mean a lot of things that used to be protected by our First Amendment, which basically protects our right to free speech and association. So the material support legislation was a bipartisan pact that was passed under the Clinton administration in 1996, and then it was expanded under Bush with the Patriot Act, and it was expanded even further this summer with a Supreme Court decision called Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project, in which the Supreme Court made a decision that activities such as political speech, which it describes as being done in a coordinated way with groups the U.S. State Department have unilaterally declared to be foreign terrorist organizations, constitutes material support for terrorism and is punishable for up to 15 years in prison. And so the material support has also been used, these laws have been used to prosecute Palestinian Americans, including the co-founders of what used to be the largest Muslim charity in the United States, the Holy Land Foundation, for giving humanitarian aid to Palestinians living under Israeli occupation, which of course is financed with our U.S. tax money. So the Supreme Court and the U.S. government argues that if groups in the United States or individuals in the United States give money to even charities that are associated with groups that it considers to be foreign terrorist organizations, that this constitutes material support because it could be used then to free up the resources for these organizations to commit violence. So it's a pretty broad definition. It's been described as by the Center for Constitutional Rights as being constitutionally vague, and even former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has objected to these laws, saying that he too is vulnerable to prosecution under them because he has been working as doing election monitoring training in Lebanon, where up until this week Hezbollah was part of the coalition government and is one of the main political parties in Lebanon. So if you're going to do elections training there, you're going to have to meet with figures from Hezbollah, which is on the U.S. State Department terrorist list.
So it's a chain that could be unraveled to many, many, many links to totally innocent humanitarian work, but through those many, many links and this kind of argument be regarded as material aid for terrorism.
Yeah, and even work to train groups on these lists or on the State Department's list to do nonviolent training with these groups, that even constitutes material support. also groups who are doing what you would think the U.S. government would want to do, which is talking to these groups about achieving their political objectives through nonviolent means, is also considered material support. And it's that kind of training that was what the U.S. Supreme Court made its decision on this summer. And so these laws are very pervasive, and they leave our free speech rights very vulnerable. And we believe that this investigation is basically a test case for this expanded definition of material support for foreign terrorist organizations.
I said in the introduction that you've been subpoenaed to appear before something called a grand jury. How does a grand jury and your subpoena differ from, let's say, you being charged with a criminal offense and having a trial in a court?
The grand jury is a mechanism that is not in practice anymore in any other country in the world, but historically it's been used by the United States government for the internment of political activists. And so what happens when you are subpoenaed to appear before a federal grand jury, and I should mention here that so far no actual crime has been identified by the U.S. government in this investigation. No one has been charged. No arrests have been made. And on the day when 70 federal agents in coordinated raids, early morning raids, burst into the homes of people with small children and into their offices and totally upended and disrupted their lives, the FBI said that day that these people pose no direct threat to the American public. So all these people, all 23 of us, have been subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury. And when you're subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury, the jury is handpicked by the United States government. You're not allowed to have a lawyer present. You're not allowed to have any witnesses present. And so it's basically a means of compelling or coercing you to inform the government about the activities of other organizers, not only here in the United States, but potentially also people that we've met when we've traveled to places like Palestine and Colombia, which seem to be what this investigation is really interested in. And so it's hardly a democratic process. In almost all cases, the U.S. government is able to get indictments, and when they aren't able to get indictments, they basically reconvene a new grand jury so they can get the indictment that they want.
You mentioned that it's been used historically against other activists. Give us some examples of that.
Before slavery was abolished, it was used to intern abolitionists, and during the Reconstruction period, it was used to jail black African-American community leaders. It was used to intern labor organizers advocating for an 8-hour workday at the turn of the last century, and it was used against civil rights leaders, and it's also been used more recently against people organizing in support of Puerto Rican independence. And so there's a long, shameful history of it being used as a means to basically round up and jail people without even accusing them of any crime. So far, the 14 people who were subpoenaed around the September 24th raids, their court dates were in October, and all 14 of them refused to testify. So their court dates came and went, but it doesn't mean that they are off the hook. So everyone is still facing a grand jury, and three of the original 14 people who were subpoenaed have had their subpoenas reactivated, which means that if they refuse to testify again once the government gives them their new court dates, if that's what the government is going to ask them to do, they face the choice of informing the government about whatever the government wants to know or going straight to jail for the life of the grand jury. So that's what we're facing here. So the grand jury is convened for 18 months at least, and it's basically indefinitely renewable. So people can go to jail for a really long time without actually being charged with any crime.
And your court date is January 25th?
Mm-hmm.
And have you decided whether you will appear?
I've decided and announced that I have no intention in participating in this fishing expedition, because I believe that not only does the U.S. government want to know the names of people that I work with and organize with here in the United States, it's also likely that they want to know people that I've met when I've traveled around and lived in the Middle East, in places like Palestine, where assuming that the U.S. government shares intelligence with the Israeli government about this stuff, for human rights activists in Palestine to be singled out this way, it's basically a prison sentence or worse for them. And I have no intention in participating in that.
Before I talk about the national campaign that's been organized to support the people like yourself who've been summoned with the subpoena, I wanted to ask you about police infiltration. I gather that police have been part of some of the groups that have been charged, and could you tell us a bit about that?
So at a press conference in the Twin Cities this week, which I believe you can watch the video of on stopfbi.net, activists revealed that their groups in the Twin Cities, the Twin Cities Anti-War Committee and the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, had been infiltrated by an undercover U.S. law enforcement agent for 2.5 years. So this person came around during the Republican National Convention when the Twin Cities Anti-War Committee was ironically organizing the permitted march to protest the Republican National Convention, which was one of the largest anti-war demonstrations in this country in the last several years. So it was a pretty significant thing. And there were lots of government infiltrators who were spying on groups at that time, but this spy decided to stick around and make herself at home. And she became involved with these groups. She became a friend to people in the movement, spent time with their kids, attended their family events. And so in doing things like this that you would think would have no investigative value, and it's basically an extreme violation of people's privacy and just morally objectionable. And so it appears that it's her word that is the basis of this investigation. And she had the key and all of the contact information for members and supporters of the Twin Cities Anti-War Committee, and it seems that her key was used by the federal authorities when it raided their office on September 24th, and it appears that she passed along information about a solidarity delegation to Palestine that was then passed on to the Israeli government, and the Israeli government deported from Tel Aviv's airport two activists and this undercover agent from Ben Gurion Airport, so they were denied the opportunity to go on this fact-finding mission to the occupied West Bank and meet with Palestinians there and hear what they have to say about the impact of U.S. foreign policy there. So this person disrupted the people's work, and it's really an incredible waste of U.S. taxpayers' money to pay for what can only be imagined to be a very large salary for this person who is disrupting the legitimate and peaceful work that people were doing.
Now, the national campaign to support all those people who've been subpoenaed before the grand jury are being persecuted for your political speech and activities. Could you tell us about the support the campaign is gaining?
Well, right away, the Committee to Stop FBI Repression was formed, and support committees have been formed in cities all around the country, and there have been massive outpourings of support. There's been hundreds of solidarity statements from various unions and groups and associations. So unions representing more than 500,000 U.S. workers have issued resolutions in support of the people facing the grand jury. Most recently in Chicago, the Chicago Teachers Union, which represents 30,000 workers, issued a statement in support of us. And there's been demonstrations in more than 60 cities. On January 25th, we're expecting that there's going to be demonstrations all around the country because a national call was put out for people to organize in support of not only the 9 activists who are facing the grand jury for the first time, but also the 3 women whose subpoenas have been reactivated, and their right to liberty is the most under threat right now. So we had a national organizing phone conference on Tuesday, and it was clear that people all around the country are working hard to organize a very visible response. And some of the actions that people are working on or have been doing are really creative. So yesterday here in Chicago, students organized an action to deliver from the People's Bureau of Investigation a giant subpoena to U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald, who we believe is the main force behind this investigation. And so they attempted to deliver this giant subpoena, issuing their demands to his office yesterday. And so we're seeing a lot of really creative actions like this. And people in the anti-war and international solidarity movements in the United States understand that it can be any one of us in these movements who are spied on next, infiltrated next, subpoena next, or, you know, we're all under threat from these material support laws, and so that's why people are standing up and calling for an end to this baseless and invasive investigation.
Well, thank you very much, Maureen, and I'll give listeners the website where they can get ongoing and up-to-date information on the campaign against the grand jury persecution, and my personal best wishes for success in your fight for the democratic right to speak freely and to organize in support of justice. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye.
My guest has been Maureen Murphy, journalist and Palestine solidarity activist in Chicago, and the website for the campaign to support all those subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury and the secret trials of a grand jury. The website is stopfbi.net.